The new book lays out the causes and potential solutions to public mass shootings in the United States. Mass shootings have gotten more common in recent years. More than half of all public mass shootings since 1966 have been committed since the year 2000. They've also gotten deadlier. 8 of the 20 deadliest mass shootings in modern history were committed in the last 5 years. Then President Barack Obama talked about the trend in 2015 after the Umpqua Community College shooting in Roseburg, Oregon, where 10 people died, including the perpetrator.
Somehow this has become routine. The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium ends up being routine. The conversation in the aftermath of it, we've become numb to this.
Our guests say amid the tragedy, there is some good news. There are a lot of proven strategies that can help prevent future shootings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests who have put a lot of time and effort over the years into studying the causes of these public mass shootings, talking to the perpetrators and their families in many cases? Are there solutions you think we are overlooking, not putting enough attention into? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. They created the first ever comprehensive database of public mass shootings in the United States, and their new book is called The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. Jillian and James, welcome both of you back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
James, in a past conversation, you talked about the different kinds of gun-related violence in the United States, in many cases requiring different solutions. I want to talk about this category you're focusing on, public mass shootings. First of all, can you just tell us about the definition, what that means?
Yeah, so we are using in the book and throughout our research a common definition that's been agreed upon by the FBI and by academic researchers, meaning 4 or more people killed in a public space. That might include a school or a place of worship, a bar or a restaurant, a workplace. And these are also crimes that tend to not have a relationship between the offender and the victims. And what we mean by that is that it's not a domestic homicide. And it's also not a homicide that occurs in the course of usual criminal behavior. So this is not a drug deal gone bad. But this is more a case of when somebody's out on the street really trying to take as many lives as possible in a public shooting.
A key point, Jill, that you've thought about for years before even this research started is it's easy to think of people who do a monstrous thing like this, a public shooting, trying to take as many lives, as James was just saying, as possible, to think of them as monsters. But you say that isn't really a productive way to think about them. Why not?
Right. And before I was an academic, I was an investigator and I worked with people facing the death penalty. And we had this saying, which was the worse the crime, the worse the story. And these are just horrific crimes that it's easy to say that the person who does this must be a monster. But that monster label doesn't get us any closer to actual prevention. When it's just a monster, it feels like there's nothing we can do about it besides practice running and hiding and fighting and give our kids bulletproof backpacks. But the reality is, if we can look at what that pathway to violence looks like over time for these individuals and really try to understand that build towards this act throughout their life, that gets us closer to really coming up with more holistic prevention strategies.
James, can you talk about the effort the two of you went to try to learn those stories, talking to, as I mentioned earlier, perpetrators, surviving perpetrators themselves, family members, victims, and others?
Yeah, that's right. So many mass shooters intend their shooting to be their final act. And so that many of them die in the act, or they're killed by law enforcement, or they take their own lives. There's a very small number of those individuals still alive. We wrote to all of them, as many as we possibly could find, fitting our definition. And we were surprised to get letters back that people wanted to talk to us. In the end, when we went through that process with the corrections department, because all these individuals are in prison for the rest of their lives, we were able to interview 5 mass shooters in prison. We were also then able to interview some of the people that knew them, family members, friends, and others in the orbit of their lives. What was then incredible about this project is as we started to get a bit more attention for the work that we were doing, people started reaching out to us with stories to tell. So we ended up spending a couple of years flying around the country, meeting with survivors of mass shootings, with family members who'd lost loved ones to these tragedies, first responders, and others who had a story to tell and a perspective on this issue. We really immersed ourselves in their lives to better understand this phenomena. In addition to building this database, which tracks mass shootings all the way back to 1966, based on a whole host of life history variables. So we really tried to come at this from what we would call a mixed methods approach, and look at it from all angles and all perspectives.
And Shill, there's not a magic profile that's going to predict who is going to commit a mass public shooting. That said, you found many common themes in these stories. What stood out to you the most?
Yeah, that's right. There's no kind of checklist we can go through to figure out if someone is going to be a mass shooter. But what we did see is these common pathways. So starting with really significant early childhood trauma, things like sexual abuse, physical abuse, the parental suicide. Then you saw number of mental health concerns over time leading to a real crisis point where the individual often became actively suicidal and their behavior was changing. People were noticing that they were acting different than they normally do. One sister described it as they go from thinking, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, to what's wrong with them. And so there's this shift, which comes the kind of hate and anger and who they blame for their misery. And then finally, there's access to weapons, to guns, and to the location that represents their grievance.
We're talking to Jillian Peterson and James Densley, authors of the new book, The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in with your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. James, when it comes to solutions, I think a lot of people have a simple solution: more security in public places, fewer guns, more mental health care, whatever the case may be. It's going to take, it seems like, if I'm reading you two right, a lot of little things, a lot of big things. There's not just one simple solution, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's about being comfortable with the complexity. And that's difficult because we're always searching for simple solutions to complex problems. And unfortunately, there's nothing there that's that easy. Now, that being said, there is some good news, which is to say that we've spent so much time pitting imperfect solutions off against each other. So we say it's either mental health or it's guns. And we are basically saying, well, can't it be both? And also, can't it be more than that too? So what we've done in the book is really try to organize solutions around things that our society can do, and that might take a bit of an act of Congress and a bit of a heavier lift, but also what institutions can do. So what can schools and workplaces and communities do to change the culture within their organizations to potentially prevent a mass shooting? And then also, what can we do as individuals to prevent a tragedy from occurring? And some of that stuff is really simple, and it's stuff that we can do right here, right now. Things around safe storage of firearms, for instance, which doesn't require any legislation. It's just something that we can all pledge to do and to support one another. And the one cool thing about this, we think, is that in addition to preventing a mass shooting, there's a diffusion of benefits that we could be preventing a suicide or an accidental shooting or a firearm getting into the hands of somebody that shouldn't have it. Or we might just be checking in with a young person who's struggling at that one moment and needs a simple act of kindness to get through the day and realize that life's still worth living and that they don't have to go ahead and perpetrate such a horrendous crime to get the attention they feel like they need. So it's a diffusion of benefits that gets us to think about violence prevention holistically. And that's why we're hopeful, actually, coming out of this research project, that as Barack Obama said at the beginning of your show, it does feel routine, but we don't have to be resigned to that routine. There is something we can do to break the cycle.
We are talking about mass public shootings in the United States with Jillian Peterson and James Densley. Their new book is called The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to prevent these mass public shootings? Our guest created the first ever comprehensive database of these kind of incidents. They talk to survivors, even perpetrators of these shootings. What do you want to know from them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with criminologists Jillian Peterson and James Densley about their new book, The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions on the topic. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I want to first say I'm a total anti-gun person, and for many years I've been in arguments with people. So I've been looking for things that might make some sense. And I heard a gentleman decades ago who said, when you come up in front of a judge and they want to charge you with this, that, and the next thing, you can never get out of that gun charge. You have to be brought up on a gun charge. Back when I was a kid, a million years ago, people used to put a comb in their pocket because they didn't want to get caught robbing somebody with a gun. And the other thing is, if people treat guns like cigarettes, you know, people came to your house and smoked in your house, even if you were a non-smoker. Now, hey, you can't smoke in my house. You know, you can't smoke in my restaurant. I'm not going to send my kids to your house because they might get secondhand smoke. Treat guns like cigarettes. And those are my two ideas. And I thank you for letting me say them.
Chris, thanks for the call. Chris, Jillian talking about, in some ways, in that last part, changing our attitude, our cultural thoughts about guns. What do you think?
Yeah, our data would really agree with that. So we found, for example, school shooters, the vast majority of them, they're too young to buy guns. They're students of the school. So they're taking them from family and family members, friends, grandparents. And so if those guns were just stored in a safe way that young people didn't have access, that would have a huge impact. And we also found a number of things that our data supports, things that kind of slow down the gun buying process. So if somebody is in crisis, is suicidal, is a threat to hurt somebody else, what can we do to make it a little bit harder for them to get their hands on guns? Things like universal background checks, things like red flag laws, things like permit to purchase wait times. So our data really supports some of those kind of common sense gun measures that really do have a lot of public support.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We'll go to another Chris in Kenosha now. Chris, hello.
I just wanted to touch up on that a little bit. So currently the government is allowed to have like a database of gun registration information, but it can't be computer searchable, if I'm correct about that. And another thing about that is, if it was computer searchable, then we would be able to enforce, you know, these red flag laws and all of that. And I just wanted that to be brought up.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I understand there's the equivalent of a card catalog for many gun references. James, does the federal government have enough tools to even research things like gun violence?
Yeah, it's a challenge because for a long time there were restrictions on, for example, the CDC to be able to research gun violence as a public health issue. And that was a barrier to really understanding the phenomena. I think the other piece about this as well is resourcing for the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms. They have been chronically under sort of resourced over the years. And this has been a barrier for instance, tracking how legal firearms get into the illegal marketplace. So what you might have is, for example, corrupt firearms dealers who are selling to prohibited purchasers. But because of the lack of resources to be able to investigate those cases, they're unable to do so. And what we saw in our research and we write about in the book is examples where people shouldn't have been in possession of firearms because they had for instance, a history of domestic violence or criminal history or other issues. But because of some certain loopholes in the system, they kind of fell through the cracks. And so a lot of this is about enforcing the laws that are on the books, but that takes resources to ensure that that people are doing what they can do to follow through on these issues.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We're talking to James Densley and Jillian Peterson, authors of the new book, The Violence Project, about ways to prevent public mass shootings in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jillian, something that stood out to me reading the book is there's a gap. If you're a teacher worried about a particular student or someone worried about a family member, you're worried that they're going to have some kind of outburst. They've had that proximate cause. They've got that background of trouble. The options are, in many cases, do nothing or call the police. The police don't have a lot of options. They can arrest someone or they can maybe hospitalize someone. Do we need something in the middle there, some kind of a mental health crisis option?
Absolutely. That is certainly what we found. We talked to mothers who would say, I was very worried about my son, but what was I going to do? Call the police on my own son and say, I think he might do something that he hasn't already done. And the police have nothing to do in those situations. So what we do need is we advocate for crisis response teams. So teams in schools and workplaces and community organizations where people can report if they're worried about someone, even anonymously. And that concern is met with intervention that is caring, that is empathetic, that really tries to match that person's needs. So not focused on criminally charging somebody, not focused on excluding them, firing them, suspending them, but really focused on figuring out what this person needs to get through this crisis point and what that long-term follow-up looks like. And we have those resources. We just have to sort of allocate our time and attention a bit differently to really be focused on prevention instead of reaction.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
You know, I was commenting to your screener. It seems that what we've been doing is just kicking the can down the road as far as like the accountability. So we have everyone try to be the same. Then somebody's a bully, and then we don't want to have bullies. And I don't think we should have bullies, but bullies are a necessary evil that you have. It corrects itself when kids are younger. I think what we do is we try to placate, we try to make everyone the same, we try to get everyone through the school system. And because these lessons, we don't let the children learn these lessons when they're 4, 5, 6 years old. That if this is what it manifests itself into, we've got 30 years of anti-bullying and prevention. And I think what it is, you know, here we close out another month of bully prevention month. And what do we have to show for it? We got more school shootings.
Kevin, thanks for the call. James, the approach to an issue like bullying in schools, what do you think?
Yeah, it's we do see that mass shooters have experienced bullying at some time in their lives, but also that in some cases that they were themselves the bullies. And I think really what it speaks to is just where we focus our time and attention within the school building. We've really got to build climates within our school that are conducive to care and compassion and support to eradicate things like bullying. So that they are not, plaguing people's lives and changing their trajectories. And I think in turn, we want to be thinking about, we have spent billions of dollars over the years on a school safety apparatus, which is really built around the kind of run, hide, fight, hardened security type of model. And could we have spent those resources differently on smaller class sizes, more counselors in schools, better crisis intervention protocols within our school communities? Whether that could have nipped in the bud some of the challenges that the caller was talking about and have steered people off of the pathway to violence later in life. And so a lot of it's just around where we put our resources and how do we support our teachers and our school administrators to ensure that they have the resources they need to provide a safe school environment for every child.
Thanks for that call. Kevin, in our last minute or so, Jillian, do you feel like the message you two are sending is being heard by people who are making important decisions about how to spend our resources most effectively to prevent these shootings?
I think it's starting. Here in Minnesota, we saw 2 years ago, the legislature passed $25 million for hardened security and bulletproof doors. And then just this last session, they also passed a new school safety budget, but this time it was about suicide prevention and counselors in schools and crisis intervention teams. So we are starting to see that shift. One of the reasons we wrote this book really for a broad audience was to really try to bring other people with us kind of through this journey that we went on in understanding this phenomenon. And the last chapter of the book is called Hope. It's really about what each of us can do to shift this narrative and really try to prevent this violence from occurring.
We'll leave it there. Jillian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And James, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in Minnesota. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. They talked to us about their new book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. By the way, if you or a loved one are struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can find help 24 hours a day at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number there is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255.